So another weird and cryptic parable, and it's really quite lovely that Paul has this whole thing about confounding human wisdom immediately before we have this whole parable that can often just befuddle the mind and really quite frustrate us. But there's one principle to human wisdom that can help us understand how this particular first reading and gospel functions. And this is almost like the law of diminishing returns. I quite don't know how it's called, but there comes a point when the type of practice or the type of work or the type of wisdom that you gain in something gradually becomes increasingly useless, and then it gets to a point when it actually becomes self-destructive. Because there's other bits of wisdom or of strength or of power or whatever that are necessary to face this new problem. And if we keep focusing on the way we've done things, then we can't cross that threshold. And one of the most powerful things that governs almost all human behavior is self-preservation. And self-preservation is pretty wise. Generally speaking, you can hear somebody describing any kind of behavior through self-preservation, and they sound pretty smart. I'm not investing in that particular thing. I'm not going on that particular trip. You know what? I'm not going to vacation in Iraq right now. I've got some other plans. This is general basic wisdom. But then there comes a point when the truly wise do things that people around them think are stupid. Or when the people around them can't even process how they're speaking and the way that they're talking. And we don't even need to speak to the Son of God on this matter. If you read Paul's writings, it is baffling. He is absolutely baffling. And an easy and controversial example is the way he writes about women. If there's any guy that as a priest I've had to sit inside a room and listen to somebody say, "I hate Paul." Why? Because he says really nasty things about women. Okay, I get it. But here's the thing. He's also the one that gave the entire foundation in the Christian tradition for the equality of men and women. There is neither Jew nor Greek, male nor female, slave nor free. He's also the principal source for the gospel according to Luke, which is filled with courageous women. And constantly, when you read his letters, he's always saying, if you want to go through the list of people that he considers to be his closest, most trustworthy friends, always going to the top of the list is like Priscilla and Aquila and all these women that to him show faith of tremendous power. And then he'll say, yeah, and there was Barnabas, but he walked off. There was John Mark, he ditched me, but you could always count on Priscilla. You could always count on these ladies. Now, what I'm trying to point out is probably he's unaware of the contrast in his own mind. And this is where a lot of modern people get really quite befuddled, because they think consciously, I'm open, I'm tolerant, I'm progressive, I'm an open-minded person, but then their family will tell you, no, they're not. When fear takes hold of them, when anxiety takes hold of them, or when they actually have to face the real details of life, they become just as close-minded, as bigoted, and as somebody that has a hat that says, let's make our country great again. There is, in a sense, where they're taken over by fear and anxiety and loss, and they stop thinking. And we're all like this. All of us. Because our wisdom is, stay alive. Stay alive. And so we're willing to throw away other values to keep that value. Basic calculation, basic thought process, and ultimately wrong. Why? Because we're not meant to stay simply alive in this world. And this is the even more amazing part, is that when we try to live self-preservationally, we, although we understand people that do it, we don't admire them. Why is it that every time we see somebody that lives to the fullness of their humanity, there are people that almost seem to constantly cheat death? It's because they're not afraid of it. Or they're more afraid of losing themselves than of dying. Think of every effective social revolution in history. They were never, ever achieved by people who were merely ideologically progressive or socially conscious or any of that. There were people that loved something, usually the truth, more than their own lives. And this image of the open-minded, progressive person who changes the world is simply an anachronism. It doesn't work. Because if you don't believe the truth is worth fighting for, when you're being tortured or when you're being killed, you will give in. Without fail. And this is also what makes it different, is that sometimes a person's own self-righteousness is their lifeline. They're not afraid of dying, but they're afraid of people not thinking they're awesome. I've met people like this too. People that would avoid treatment, avoid care, or avoid anything just so that they don't have people see their weakness. And Paul wasn't like that either. Paul advertises how foolish he is, how incapable he is. He even at one point says, I'm actually pretty ugly, and I'm unattractive, and I'm a poor speaker, and so if you're listening to me, it's not because of these things. And this is also what gives the church power and strength, is that when we're doing our job right, we don't advertise like the world. If we were merely worldly, people would start saying, oh, well, I really love our parish because our priest is an attractive, intelligent person with a smile and blah, 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 blah. Because what happens? He's gone. They're gone. Or people say, I go to this church because I love the people. I love the community. Blah, 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 blah. Good, lovely things. But what happens when there's one bitter person that walks inside the church? Gone. And then the whole reason for being there? Gone. But what made the early Christians stand out? They knew that Christ had saved them. And so they're willing to put up with obnoxious priests. There are many of them. And I'm not saying who you're thinking about. I'm thinking this guy right here. There are many obnoxious and frustrating people. You will encounter them. There are many evils and injustices that we will encounter. They are all around us. But has he loved us? Is that worth struggling for? You bet. And that's where faith starts to become operative. The virgins in the parable, they wanted to get the result without putting in the work. They didn't actually see the celebration as worth struggling for. And therefore, they were also willing to take other people down with them. And sometimes we can do exactly that. We are faced with the cross in our own life, and we're afraid to deal with it. And this is endemic in the church. We have a cross in our life that only we are ordained to carry. And then because we're afraid to carry it, we dump it on other people. I have an insecurity, I dump it on somebody else. I make them feel insecure so that I can feel secure. This is a classic pattern of behavior where it's a type of transference. I want to avoid my inner pain, and so I force it on somebody else. And if you listen to modern political and religious discourses, I gotta say, the blame game is a definite sign of this problem. How does God answer the problem? He who is blameless accepts blame for everything. He who is without sin becomes sin for us. Oh. That doesn't sound like it makes sense. That doesn't sound like wisdom. But then again, when we actually see it in action, we know exactly how it works. When you are angry at your spouse, or you're angry at your friend, and you know you've done something wrong, and you know they've done something really wrong to you, if you apologize while making an accusation, totally useless. Totally useless. But if you go up to your spouse or your friend or your coworker or whatever, and you say, I did this. I'm sorry. No qualifications. No explanations. owning responsibility for the part of the problem in which we are responsible. How often have we done that? And two, when that apology has happened, how successful has it been? I can guarantee you, if you've done it, you've been amazed at the results. Sometimes it's not always successful, but generally it is. Because the person then doesn't feel that your feeling of right, your feeling of righteousness does not come at their expense, but that your apology is for their good. And that's exactly what Jesus has done with us. I've been thinking a lot for the last few months that the crucifixion is God's way of saying, in a sense, I'm sorry you don't understand why you have to suffer in this life. I am sorry you don't understand why there is so much pain and evil in the world. And I can't take away your sin or take away your suffering without fixing his or hers or his. Because I don't want to unveil her secrets and her problems to you. So all I've been able to do is to be silent. But as I hang here, know that I am not washing my hands of you. Know that in every stage, I want to be with you and to not abandon you and to walk with you and to bear this burden and to bear this difficulty. When we know that's what God has done for us, we understand that powerful wisdom. We understand what truly makes for a saint. Not a morally perfect, righteous person. We have many of those, and they're pretty obnoxious. People that give mercy. People that are willing to stand and to not have other people bear their burdens, but are more willing to bear the burdens of others. Christ came to make us rich out of his poverty. And the more we've received those riches, the wealthier we act.